Should I just howl?
Only if it's an Allen Ginsberg like howl.
What would that be?
Like a 2,000-line poem.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, that's the only howl I'm up for today.
Okay, no, I got none of that.
Okay, so we're not going to do the usual intro and outro, and I'm going to put any music on this episode.
And why is that?
Because this is a hot take. Grace is actually going to be traveling this weekend.
Yes.
So she's not going to be around for a number of days, and yeah. I got to record something tonight if I want to get something out on Sunday.
Yeah.
So
here we are.
Here we are. There is a danger, however, that events may overtake us.
Well, yeah, we'll have all this to say, and things will be very different Sunday evening.
Because the situation seems to be changing rapidly. Although,
yeah.
I think it's actually going to settle down after this period of
extraordinary violence.
Extraordinary violence.
So, we're talking about Gaza.
We're talking about Gaza tonight.
Because, this is all up in our feed.
Yeah.
And all up in our grill.
You know, I keep seeing all these activists on Twitter getting shouted down and getting blocked and getting into fights. And I'm like, why can't I get in these fights? Because I keep posting. I keep posting and I get like nothing, you know, like silence. One like, you know.
I wonder if you've been shadow banned.
Well, that's what I think. And I have noticed that I have been unfollowed it in the sense that there were accounts that I was following and I expect to see posts from that mm-hmm. suddenly I was seeing other people retweeting, but they weren't showing up in my feed. And then that's I looked weird. At my list of accounts that I follow and I had been unsubscribed, like unfollowed from a number of leftist accounts.
Right. They didn't unfollow you.
No. And right. I didn't unfollow them.
You
Twitter,
just weren't connected.
Twitter made me unfollow them.
Twitter disconnected you.
Somehow. And a lot of people have been reporting similar things.
It's the magic like, of the internet.
Yeah, like people who subscribe to, say, Jimmy Dore's show on YouTube or other left-wing shows, suddenly they're just gone. You know, they're not subscribers anymore.
Those leftists are dangerous. I mean, you can't, like, you know, encourage
Russian propaganda, baby.
I'm telling you. It's going to lose the 2018 elections, just so everybody knows. I'm calling it now, just so you know. All right, just, you know, get your hankies out now. Do your healing now so you're ready when it comes.
I'm ready for Trump in 2020, honestly.
Yeah, really.
Because I don't see any they got credible.
Nothing. They got nothing.
There's no credible opposition. And in fact, it looks like they're going to confirm Haspel. More women torturers. More women torturers. That's Democratic Party feminism, baby.
Yeah.
That's Clintonism for you.
Yeah.
She's breaking the glass ceiling.
And we're here for it. Not God. At all. Yes. So Gaza kind of blew up this week. And I think that's, I normally don't like to do current events. But I think this is, we can't turn away.
I have a little disclaimer, which is like years ago, I was reading book after book on Israel-Palestine. I had shelf feet of this stuff and articles every day, and I felt pretty well informed about it. But that was a while ago, and I've kind of lost touch.
I don't think you're actually out of the loop than the average American.
Oh, no, I don't think that.
And I think you're probably at least as in the loop as any of our listeners.
Maybe.
Okay.
We'll see.
And not much has changed except for the body count.
The body count and thing, you know, restrictions have been loosened, restrictions have been tightened, you know, there have been retaliatory attacks, this, you know, CAS led and this other operation.
It's
and that
like
other
the
operation.
Noam Chomsky.
Yeah,
saw.
the current conflict in the Middle East. The joke is that Noam Chomsky used to schedule talks like literally years in advance.
Yeah, four or five years later.
And he would say, what's the title of your talk? And he'd say, the current conflict in the Middle East. He was pretty confident that there would be one.
There would be one.
Yeah.
So that could be the title.
So I'm going to set up a few things. I'm going to quote a few folks. This is a little disorganized. This is what a hot take means.
Just jumping right in case you haven't seen the news.
Yeah.
as many as 60 people have been killed in Gaza on the anniversary of al-Nakba as the United States opened an embassy in Jerusalem.
So we'll get into that and we'll talk about why the embassy move is significant.
Yeah.
And why the anniversary is significant.
Yeah.
But I want to...
So 60 dead, some of them children, some of them infants.
Some of them journalists.
Some of them journalists, some of them physicians. 2,400 wounded with live ammunition.
Yep.
And before we talk anything about how they were armed with rocks and wheelchairs and tennis rackets.
Yeah, I saw the picture of the guy with the tennis racket, like... He's going to lob a tear gas canister back towards towards the IDF.
God bless him.
Well, actually, not since you said that, I think that the IDF and the people who support their statements are imagining something like the scene in the Two Towers.
Yes.
The Battle of Helm's Deep.
Yeah.
Where... the orcs have planted gunpowder bombs in the culvert underneath
the wall,
the Deeping Wall,
right,
and,
which is their ironclad defense,
right. And then from far away, an orc all
deep in the
covered
crowd.
In armor appears, and he's carrying a giant Olympic torch,
and he's racing towards the culvert.
And Aragorn cries out. Legolas, bring him down, take him down. And Legolas shoots him full of arrows, but yet he dives in, and with his dying breath, he touches off a massive explosion that takes down, that breaches the deeping wall, and then
and
the orcs just swarm through. And I think that people really believe that, like, that's the situation.
Yeah, that's what they're facing.
Like, you let one... He let
one of these
one,
guys through
one person in
with his rockin'
Gaza
tennis racket
touch the fence, and it's all going down. It's just going to be
the whole thing's going down.
And the reason they imagine it that way is solely their racist views of the Palestinian people.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and their supremacist views of themselves.
Yes.
Right. And I don't think this was my immediate thought. It was like, do they really mean to suggest that their defenses are that fragile?
That one person gets through and suddenly the entire, Gaza just empties like a balloon.
They have this really fragile weak point that the Palestinians could breach with one person.
Yeah.
And that's how fragile their defenses are.
It's that
it's deeply
if you
absurd.
Think of it that way, it kind of explains this disproportionate response. In other words, if you understand their view of it,
that they really think that their safety is that fragile,
then that sort of explains the response.
There's also this understanding, I believe, in Israel. I'm going to use the wrong number. I think the number is like 67 dead Palestinians elicits the concern of over one dead Israeli,
something like that.
That in Israel proper, the the sort of the zeitgeist, the feeling is like one Palestinian dead is like what? So and
right.
But one Israeli dead, it's as if 60 or 70 or 100 Palestinians are dead.
Yes.
Then you see that kind of response from Israelis on the street.
Right.
Yeah.
No, it's I used to read the Journal of Palestinian Studies and they would just lay out a catalog in each issue of all the deaths,
all the
injuries,
right.
all the shootings, all the incursions, all the fights. And the numbers are something along those proportions. So I want to talk about a few things. This is Juan Cole, our buddy Juan.
Mm-hmm. He's a local
University of Michigan. He publishes on Truth Dig and Common Dreams and probably some other blogs as well.
And he's got his own Informed Consent, I believe.
Informed Comment.
Informed Comment is his blog.
Yeah. So he talks about something that people have been sharing on Twitter, which is that the New York Times, CNN, and The Guardian ran these stories under headlines that just talked about Palestinians dying. in yes. like in the passive sense.
As they just
Palestinians just dying.
It just happened.
And they really made it sound like, you know, there's this plague just sweeping through the Palestinians for no apparent reason.
At the Gaza border. Know. It's weird.
Yeah. And they did clean that up. Like, enough people complained to the New York Times and said, this is hardly unbiased, you know.
Right. They didn't just die.
That they did change that wording. But CNN used the wording that clashes resulted in deaths, right? And Cole points out that there were no clashes.
Yeah.
There was no fighting.
No.
The Palestinians died on their side of the Israeli fence. No Israelis were injured, and all of the injuries were caused by Israeli fire. This may not be strictly true. I did read one report of one IDF soldier who was like suffered minor injuries from stone throwing or something like that. You know,
really?
I did one.
Like, how?
I don't know, because the other part of this is they're shooting from mostly from a long distance away, from hundreds of yards away.
Hundreds of yards away.
Yeah.
And people are throwing stones 20, 30 feet.
But I did read that. Now, okay. They also, from what I've been reading, mm-hmm. you know, it's not entirely accurate to say that the Gazans are armed only with stones and tennis rackets and things like that.
Well, largely,
They have been launching incendiary kites. Right, which caused forest fires.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That's happened. They have been rolling burning tires towards the fence and whatnot. Mm-hmm. The burning tire thing, though, I think their goal is largely to have the smoke impede the view of the snipers.
Right.
Right.
So fewer people get shot.
Yeah. And this is, you know, this is a provocative protest.
Yeah. Right?
It is intended to be a provocative protest.
Yeah.
People are camping within this border zone, and mm-hmm. I'm going to talk about that wording and what this zone means a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But they're setting up tents, they're walking in groups, they even have been holding weddings within this no-go zone, right? Mm-hmm. Intentionally.
Yes.
And we'll talk about a little bit about why things have gotten to the point where they would provoke a response.
Yeah.
Deliberately. Cole talks about why his view, sort of why this wording is so strange and mm-hmm. why we have such difficulty admitting that Israelis kill Palestinians under the aegis of American support.
Yeah.
And in his view, this is a quote, "It is because the West categorizes Palestinians as dinosaurs, not mammals."
Yes.
"They're the last colonial subjects. They're not citizens. They have no state. There is no contemporary category for them. They are unique." And I would add, because they have no state, they have no state to protect them.
Yeah.
So he describes them as all inmates, said it's the last colony, a relic of the early 20th century when Britain bestrode the globe as an imperial behemoth ruling India, Malaya, Nigeria, colonies that went on to become independent countries.
Mm-hmm.
And among the more important countries in the world, not so the British Mandate of Palestine.
Right. Yeah, it's true. Even Puerto Ricans and what's the other one in the Pacific Ocean?
Marshall Islands.
They're American citizens.
Yeah, technically, the Trump administration has been treating them.
Doesn't mean shit, but like, they're American citizens.
Like non-entities.
Right. I mean, they're American citizens on paper. Right. So, yeah, there's that.
"Colonial subjects were always invisible to the metropolitan press. They were mm-hmm. supposed to be like Victorian children, seen but not heard, and were to produce profits for imperial capital."
Yeah. Did you guys know?
So I'm skipping ahead a little bit. I'm not going to read the whole piece, but "The tragedy in Palestine involves complex moving parts. Instead of insisting on Ashkenazi Jews' rightful place in post-war Europe, especially in Germany and Poland, mm-hmm. the Europeans, including Britain, were happy to dump the Holocaust survivors in the Levant, mm-hmm. where they could be turned into compradors against rising Afro-Asian nationalisms.
Yeah.
Mauled by Central European virulent racist nationalism, some Jews replied with Betar, Likud, and other Jewish supremacist organizations modeled on the mass politics of the interwar period and accepting many of the premises about racial hierarchies and the desirability of belligerency.
Mm-hmm.
The British colonial authorities abruptly withdrew, allowing the Jews they had brought to Palestine for imperial purposes to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians.
Yes.
Part of the history, 70% of the Palestinian families in Gaza are refugees from what is now southern Israel, right, trapped in the Gaza Strip and denuded of property, dignity, and prospects. That is why Palestinians in Gaza are rallying at the fence and insisting that the world will not be allowed to forget 2 million stateless persons trapped and under blockade in an Israeli concentration camp. Tell us a little bit about the right of return and this protest, if you would.
So the deal is what you just described occurred 1948. And the anniversary is actually today.
Yeah.
Today is actually the anniversary. And Israelis remember it as the founding of Israel, and Palestinians remember it as El Nakba, as in like the nightmare.
Yeah.
That is the day they were all driven from their homes and forced to leave at gunpoint. And that is the day they became refugees. That was 70 years ago. Yeah. So for some people, it's living memory.
Some people, it's still living memory.
Still living memory. Some people have survived. Well,
certainly the memory of families.
Families, absolutely. Now, right of return. You want to talk about Israel's right of return? You want to talk about Palestine's right of return?
Well,
you want to talk about
briefly both, if you would. You know.
Okay. So
because one is used as a weapon, the other is held out as a carrot. Right?
As a carrot. So the idea is, okay, if we can negotiate a peace, so like all of Europe and everybody that. So let's just back up a little bit and put some of this stuff in context. Okay. So, to begin with, Europeans decided, you know, after the Holocaust, the fact is we never really liked the Jews.
Yes.
Wouldn't it be great if we could just get them the hell out of here?
Right.
And decided to give them what was Palestine, the British Mandate of Palestine.
Yeah.
They can just have that.
Yeah.
They can all go there, and we don't have to deal with them anymore.
Yep.
All right? So, Jews have... Israel has, for Jews, something called Aliyah, or a right of return. All Jews are welcome to come to Israel because it's a Jewish homeland. So there aren't Jews. So any Jews in the diaspora have a place to return. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that
you can go on a birthright trip.
You can go on a birthright trip and,
you know,
all these things, right?
Party with the IDF.
Party with the IDF and, you know, et cetera, ad infinitum. And it's weaponized in this thing where the Jewish settlements. Now, mind you, in 48, Al-Nakba happened. Palestinians were driven from their land and their homes, and the Jewish state was established, of Israel was established. And in 67, about 20 years later, there was another war, Six Days War.
Yep.
And I believe it was Egypt, Syria, and Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to push Israel back,
right,
so that Palestine could have space.
Define some borders.
Define some borders.
Yeah.
And we have now something referred to as the 1967 borders, and it's like 40% Palestine and 60% Israel, right? In what was the British Mandate of Palestine.
Right. But then since then.
So since then.
Just this,
so,
this nonstop gradual process
of encroachment.
And settling. And
the process settlement is Jews make Aliyah.
Right.
And they're welcome to form settlements.
Right.
Anywhere.
Right.
And they make those settlements in Palestine.
In Palestinian land.
In Palestinian land. And then Israel.
Backed
says,
by and supported by the government.
The government, the IDF,
and the, IDF.
And the United States military. To be just to be clear.
Right.
That, you know, the understanding is if you come through the IDF, the U.S. military is waiting behind them.
Right.
Okay. So, and what you have is all these settlements kind of dotting through Palestine, and Israel started making settler-only roads from Israel proper to the settlements.
Right.
And connecting them so that this encroachment has led to what is now
garrisons everywhere.
These armed garrisons everywhere. And basically, Gaza is this concentration camp where most of...
Yeah, it's the biggest one.
It's the largest one where most of Palestine is.
Largest contiguous piece of...
Piece that's of, left. Of, all yeah. the rest of it, it looks like Swiss cheese.
Yeah, and it's
there's
it's
more
crazy.
Holes than cheese.
It's crazy.
It's absolutely absurd.
You can watch animations of this, generations of maps
of
redrawn.
This land grab process. Yeah. Right?
Now, there was in 2005, Israel did actually remove some settlements from Gaza and establish the current...
And it was surreal.
The current border, right. so to speak. Right. But I want to emphasize, so people always talk about this, well, why would these Palestinians approach the border of Israel?
Oh, wait, and, there's more.
Well, go ahead. Let me make my point. Mm-hmm. This is not a border.
Right.
Right? Israel does not have a border there.
No.
Right. So, because Palestinians living on one side of this fence, and this is demarcation line, this right. zone, are not it's not a nation.
Right, yeah.
And so the nation of Palestine does not have a border with the nation of Israel there.
It's better to imagine yes. that the 67 borders drew lines in the sand around Palestinian reservations yes. inside the state of Israel.
Yes.
That's a much better understanding.
Exactly.
So there's like no fence around the Lakota nation.
But Israel has consistently failed to maintain or respect any of those borders.
Any of those
and
borders.
Redraws them freely and at will
at
over
will.
Time.
And arbitrarily.
Yeah, arbitrarily.
Right. So Palestinians keep demanding a right of return to their homes and property as far back as 1948.
Which, yeah, many of, like you say, many of their families remember the homes they lived in.
Which are now occupied by Israelis.
Only miles away.
Just miles
from,
away.
From their current, like, reservations
Ration.
Or concentration camps.
Which, and I think
refugee,
Americans...
Refugee camps, really.
I think it would be better if we understood that these terms, refugee camp, concentration camp, and reservation... Mm-hmm. have some interchangeability.
They're all approximations for the situation.
Right, they're all approximations for the situation. They're all approximations for the same thing. And I think it's really relevant if you come to understand that that's the nature of what's happening to natives in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So if you understand
yeah, yeah.
that situation,
sure.
you have a better understanding of Palestine.
Sure.
If you understand Palestine, you have a better understanding of, the, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So the concentration yeah. camps that Japanese were interred in, if
yeah.
you understand that, you have a better understanding, a better grasp right. of what's happening in Palestine.
And the situation of so many millions, well, almost 2 million in Gaza is somewhat unique in this
yeah.
refugee situation because many of them, are, like we said, are literally living just miles away from
their homes,
their former homes.
And so in negotiations, the right of return of Palestinians is often this bargaining chip that's held up like a carrot.
Yes.
Well, that could still happen if you
if
would just,
we,
you know.
Yeah, if you guys will just
give up some more.
Prop up a decent negotiating partner, you know,
you
that
know,
we like.
That we pick.
Stop fighting back, you know, stop
for
protesting.
Example.
Or whatever, against anything, you know.
Against anything.
Whatever
and
we care to throw at you.
Historically, there's been conversation about a two-state solution.
Yeah,
where there's
absolutely.
A Palestinian state and there's an Israeli state. And...
The traditional thinking about a two-state solution was to return to the 1967
borders
and largely undo a lot of the settlers.
Like to roll back
work.
A lot of the settlers and all the stuff
yeah,
and return to the 67 borders,
yeah,
right?
Right, and that's so far gone.
That's, I think we've crossed that bridge.
Yes.
And I think...
Burned that bridge
with prejudice. Pun intended. The problem, I dare to say, I think there's only, it may have only ever been possible, a one-state solution.
Yes.
Right? And I don't mean dissolving the state of Israel.
No, we mean a state in which they don't have second-class citizens. That's
right.
not an apartheid state
It's not an
anymore.
Apartheid state. It can't be an apartheid state. You can't yeah. have second-class citizens. Now, mind you, I'm not exactly an advocate for that plan. I think it's actually, it may be the only thing possible.
It is. There's this issue people talk about a lot, which is the demographic crisis.
Right.
And because basically I kind of wanted to end with this, but I think we should throw it in now, which is Gaza is a ticking time bomb, a demographic time bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And the Palestinian families have far more children per family than the Israelis.
Than the Israelis, right.
And their population is rapidly growing.
Mm-hmm.
They are in serious crisis as far as calories, access to clean water, access to energy, access to everything.
Everything.
They are basically occupied. They are contained. They don't have access to airspace. Their airport was destroyed. Right. They can't enter and exit
freely Gaza in any way. Right.
And their population keeps growing. And they keep getting hammered with, things like Operation Cast Lead, their medical facilities, their everything.
Any resources they may scrape together inside of Gaza are destroyed. Rather systematically, to be honest.
At some point, this has to end, because at some point, 3 million desperate Gazans will just walk.
Will just walk and keep walking and won't stop.
Yeah.
Israelis will run out of bullets.
Yeah. And then what, they're going to nuke Gaza?
Don't say it out loud.
It can't continue.
It just can't go on like this.
And this is why, basically, so I believe that, Israel is celebrating, it's the 70th anniversary of the founding of the State of Israel. There will not be a 75th anniversary celebration.
Not like this.
Not at this rate.
Not at this rate, not under these terms.
Because if they continue to squeeze Gaza, within a couple of years, the death toll in Gaza will be so high. I've got to have faith that the Israeli community will
have
pass
to say
their revulsion
for what's happening,
reach their point of revulsion. It hasn't happened yet.
The ratchet of racism,
oh God,
is really effective at tamping down your revulsion.
It is. When you grow up to believe that the Palestinians are,
orcs,
drugged roaches in a bottle,
insert vulgar characterization of your choice.
Right.
Yeah. Sand niggers.
Yeah.
That's a popular term.
Yeah. That's true. You dehumanize them and you don't have to think of them as dead. As dead people.
Right.
But I don't know. I still hold out hope that these deaths will have some meaning, in the sense that they will eventually activate some kind of...
Here's the thing. South Africa recalled their ambassador from Israel in response to these attacks.
That's the only country that
did. But I have to say, if South Africa is saying, dude, whoa, that's extreme.
Nikki Haley walked out of the UN... rather than sit through a brief statement by the Palestinian envoy to the United Nations. Right.
Yeah.
Not even a recognized,
Not even a recognized member of diplomat.
But an envoy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's an embarrassment.
Jesus. Yeah, and she talked about how she was impressed by the measured and, rational response to this, and said, if this was happening on your... What she said is, if this kind of thing were happening on your border, no country would tolerate this. It's not a border.
It's not a border. It's a reservation.
Yes.
And in fact, there was a lot of pushback when we tried to behave this way at Standing Rock.
Yes.
We tried to behave this way.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of media attention, and there was a lot of scorn for what we did do.
Right.
Right? Which was outrageous, but nothing like this.
Yeah.
And we received scorn for what we did do when this did happen in our country.
Now, just to put the matter in some perspective, the death toll in these recent protests is actually small compared to the airstrikes.
Yeah.
The airstrikes on Gaza that
have
happened
the worst
in recent
since 2014.
Years.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there we had, 1,500, dead. So maybe I'm just getting my hopes up again in this,
Maybe
I'm just getting ready to kick the football again.
I think you're onto something.
The demographics are making it a crisis that must be resolved in
some way.
Right. And you know, maybe the way is genocide of every person in Gaza.
I think that's Israel's goal.
Well,
to be perfectly honest, I think that's their goal.
It's hard to believe that. Well, I can't say anything about America because I believe America will happily
commit genocide. Are
you happily kidding? Commit genocide. But it's hard to believe the rest of the international community won't find some way to pressure us.
The international community didn't do anything about Rwanda.
Yeah.
The international community isn't doing anything about the Congo. The international community, I don't really have a lot of faith in the international community. I suspect that Israel's endgame is a genocide of the Palestinians. I mean, because that's what they're doing right now.
And
it's
they
just
can
slow
turn
motion.
The Gaza Strip into
beach.
Into resorts.
Waterfront property. Wouldn't it be beautiful?
Yeah.
And I think their goal was to do it slowly enough that the international community didn't notice or something.
Yeah.
I think this pushes them to the point where they have to do it openly and without reservation.
Or they just can't keep up.
They can't keep up. And I think it's going to cost them in a way that, you know.
Yeah.
Even if there is a 75th celebration, it won't look like this year's.
No.
Or the 50th.
Yeah. So, I mean, we talked about how, for many presidencies, the goal seemed to be a two-state solution. And America did actually push
for a two-state solution.
The Israeli government, historically, going back to Carter and before, towards a two-state solution.
Yep.
And that was a significant thing that was happening.
Which,
talk about a little bit about why the embassy is important.
Okay, so there's two things going on with the embassy.
Yeah.
On the one hand, Jerusalem has never been understood as the capital of Israel for political reasons.
Right.
It is a sacred Christian site.
Right. Jerusalem goes way back. Gotta
way
understand.
Back. Okay.
Way back.
So like when we talk about Easter.
Before any modern countries.
And we talk about,
Right.
Jesus.
Yes.
We were talking about Jerusalem.
Yes.
Okay. It's a Christian holy site. It is a Muslim holy site.
Yep.
And it is a Jewish holy site. And for that reason, it was deemed politically
inexpedient.
Inexpedient.
Yes.
To give it to one group as
one
their
country.
To one country as their political capital.
Right.
I mean, yeah, it just this that wasn't going to work.
This is why the capital of Israel was Tel Aviv.
Exactly.
Tel Aviv.
It was in Tel Aviv and not in Jerusalem because it's a sensitive religious holy site and it shouldn't be the political capital of a state.
Right.
Okay. So we just don't do that. We don't go there, etc.
And
for
the
Jews?
The Palestinians are occupying, live in East Jerusalem.
East Jerusalem, a little sliver of Jerusalem.
Yeah, you think the map of the settlements over time is complicated.
Jerusalem.
The map of Jerusalem is crazy. It's like drawn by a person having a seizure, these boundaries and borders between neighborhoods and streets.
And this one is for us, and this one's for you, and
yeah.
This one's... So, because it is this very sensitive space that culturally belongs to many different groups.
But historically, what I hear from people that lived there or have been there is that it's this incredible multicultural place.
Yeah.
Where these religions and cultures actually do coexist.
It's amazing. Now I remember a talk by a Palestinian woman talking about growing up in Palestine.
Yeah.
And she was a Palestinian Christian.
Yeah.
And she said, I need you guys to understand, as a child I would spend Christmas in Bethlehem and Easter in Jerusalem.
That's amazing.
And I can't imagine that a day would come that I did something else.
Right.
So the idea that it would be some state's territory
some
as their political capital?
State's political capital.
Is, it's frankly, horrifying.
Right. And it's right? Certainly not going to do anything good for the peace process.
For the peace process.
Or any hope of the
any
peace
hope
process.
Any hope of peace process. Especially for Muslims
Trump,
surrounding the area. And,
So Trump's signing on to this Zionist idea.
Yeah.
This Christian Zionist
idea. Well, Trump's signing on to the Christian Zionist idea. But in the hearts of many Zionists,
yes,
the hearts of many Jews,
yeah,
and Israelis, the idea that one day, maybe somehow, some way, Jerusalem would be the capital of Israel again.
Sure. Next year in Jerusalem. Right?
Exactly.
We
say that in our Seder every year. It's a very soft, special dream for Israelis and Jews.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's not lost on me.
Right.
But if you want a safe and secure Israel.
The idea that you can hold your Seder in Jerusalem doesn't mean it's Israel's capital.
It's Israel's capital, right?
Necessarily.
Necessarily. But also, if you also value a safe and secure Israel,
yes,
you wouldn't push that button right now.
No, really, you would not.
You would not push that button at all.
Yeah, it's definitely
I wouldn't do that.
No, don't do that.
Don't do that.
And everyone told the administration,
don't do that.
This is going to result in violence.
But the Christian Zionist idea,
yeah,
is that it's only good.
The violence is only good.
The violence it's a bloodbath.
Because this is Armageddon.
Right.
And this is what we need to enable the return of our Lord Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And
it's a sick idea.
Right?
That the slaughter of adolescents and children is somehow part of bringing Jesus back.
Yeah.
So anyway. I did talk about the Palestinian right of return and the way it's a carrot, and there was another thing about, what was it? Did I miss a point? Did I cover everything you were thinking about?
You covered the Palestinian right of return, the Jewish right of return, right, for mm-hmm. for the Jews in diaspora.
Right.
Right. You covered the idea of the Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. We didn't talk much about East Jerusalem as the capital of a possible future Palestinian state, but just as the Palestinian right of return has been held out as a carrot for Palestinians to encourage them to engage in the peace process, i.e., you know, let us
terms
do
of their
everything,
surrender.
Yeah,
right.
Let us do everything we want and treat you like, you know, slaves.
How about that?
Murder you with impunity.
Just a thought. I'm asking
the idea that East Jerusalem might serve as a Palestinian state within, you know, a fragmented sort of convoluted Palestinian state within the borders of Israel.
With their own separate roads.
That's been a carrot that has been held out to Palestinians as part of, to encourage them to engage in some kind of peace process.
Yeah. And it's...
Yeah. And this movement of the embassy and the declaration of, it's not just that they moved a building to a different building.
No.
It's a declaration that this is the capital.
The capital of Israel. Yeah.
It's recognized by the United States.
Like, you know, right around Al-Nakba, to do it as part of this celebration.
This is Sheldon Adelson's work.
This is the work of
American Zionist billionaires and APAC supporters and just the worst of the worst who really just want to flip off, you know, the rest of the Middle East.
And be damned, you know, do it, you know, yeah. Nana, nana, boo, boo, die mad about it.
Yeah.
You know, it's really, they're playing with people's lives.
Yes.
Like it's, I don't know, a game or funny or I don't even know what.
It's in the same way that, like, you know, Trump does everything. Like telling his supporters, well, you know, beat the crap out of him at a rally.
Well, and I got to say, though, 45 is tripping the light switch on this, right? He's flipping the switch.
Right.
But
no, he's
folks
just,
have been aching he, for this
oh,
for
sure,
a long
sure.
time.
Yeah.
Bibi's been waiting
it's
for
just
this.
Most American presidents have been like listening to enough smart people telling them, oh no, that's not really a good idea. But now we have, you know, I guess we have Boy Wonder
whatever
in charge of the peace process,
well,
his son-in-law, right? Among his many Jewish friends. Portfolio of duties he was handed was solve the Middle East peace process, and this is
we'll move it to the capital, Jerusalem. It'll
this
be great.
Is, yeah, the solution.
So, yeah. The I have to say, though, past presidents, I just want to draw a distinction. That the distinction is a matter of...
Not even degree, but
explicit and implicit. So past presidents have been willing to undermine Palestine in every respect and willing to go along and nod at their ongoing genocide of the Palestinian people, right?
Yeah.
And do it with the United States blessing and money.
Imprimatur.
With our imprimatur.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Go forth and do it. They've only given public lip service to the idea of a Palestinian state. They've only ever given public veneer at the idea that, oh, this is horrible, that we wouldn't want that to happen. This current administration is willing to go ahead and provoke it because their base needs to show up in November.
Right.
So they'll provoke it.
Yeah. Even the Bush administration, with their many, many failings,
showed more restraint.
They actually showed some resistance to the settler activities.
Because they have a different base.
Yes.
And that's the only reason why. They have a different base. The Democratic Party is actually more beholden to AIPAC.
Yes.
And
they certainly are.
And so
almost Democrats have spoken up
about any of this.
About any of this, even to offer up a tweet,
radio silence,
including Cory Booker, Kamala Harris,
goddamn cop,
all these resistance fighters.
The fuck are they resisting?
They are not useful for anything. I just
maybe they're
wrote
useful
on
idiots.
Facebook,
useful idiots. No?
It's not my intent to ever support a Democrat for pretty much anything again. Unless I'm that Democrat, or someone I know personally.
I don't know. I mean, I have to live separately if you're a Democrat, Paul. I don't know.
And manage to... it raises a tactical question.
Right.
Do you try to organize within the Democratic Party? I think it's a reasonable question. This is not really my topic for tonight, but...
But...
It's a reasonable question whether you would even try.
Why would you try?
Yeah.
So, but actually... I do want to bring this much up. I just want to reframe or back up from this frame that, oh my God, look what Trump's doing. It's not actually, it's the only difference is that this is explicit and provocative instead of implicit with plausible deniability. That's actually the only difference.
Mm-hmm.
And he's intentionally being provocative and explicit because it feeds his base.
Right.
The Democrats have a different base. Old school Republicans have a third different base that they're responding to. And so their policy with regards to Israel reflects that base.
Yeah.
That's all we're looking at. But the position, genocide of Palestine is just fine.
Yeah.
Has not been different.
No.
That's not actually new.
No.
So I
not
think
if
it's
no, yeah, no, not if not no Democrats any notable will way. Stand up.
No, not in any notable way. So I really want to back away from, oh my God, look what he's done now.
No, it's not. So there are, we talked a little bit about this on a previous show, but there are only a couple things Trump's actually done that I think are actually, actually give me pause and okay, this is a serious thing.
Yeah.
I mean, not to minimize anyone's suffering under, being rounded up by ICE or whatnot, or warehoused or droned or
anything
else.
Because I haven't
done
that. I don't minimize that.
Right.
Unlike other people I know.
Right. But so far the two most serious
new things
are pulling out of the Iran deal.
Yeah.
And this provocation with the with the embassy and the recognition of the Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Those are bad.
Yeah.
Those are bad things.
I think you need to understand that this Gazan protest that we're looking at right now is kind of foreshadowing of what's to come as demographics in Gaza change.
Yeah. And it's not just Gaza either.
Right, right. No, there are other pockets.
Yeah. Gaza is the largest concentrated pocket of Palestinian population.
Right.
Anyway. I was thinking that I had a couple things I wanted to say about life under occupation, but I don't know, is it worth going into to talk about the situation there.
Give people a brief overview. People may not know.
People may not know. So I talked about how the border of Gaza, you know, was not a border.
It's not a border.
In any reasonable sense of, mm-hmm. of that word. It's not a border between nations,
right.
between countries.
Right.
The international community, this is from Wikipedia, regards all the Palestinian territories, including yeah. Gaza.
Just being inclusive. It's okay.
As occupied. The Oslo Accord authorizes Israel to control the airspace and the sea. So,
you try to send medical supplies to Gaza by boat, Israel blow it out of the water.
Israel has exclusive control over the airspace. It can interfere with radio and TV transmissions. Again, according, like in treaty, right?
In treaty. You know, like legally. This is the, you know.
The Palestinian Authority cannot engage in independent initiatives for operating a seaport or airport. So they did authorize Palestinians to construct an airport, and it was running.
Until they blew it up.
It was blown up in the second Intifada, 2001, yeah. 2002.
Yeah.
So Israel flies drones over Gaza.
With impunity.
Part of the territory is depopulated because of this buffer zone on both the Israeli and Egyptian, well, the word borders, but you know what
right.
I...
Yeah.
So, and this has been completely capricious and arbitrary, right?
Right.
Initially, Israel imposed a 50-meter buffer. In
for
2000,
safety.
It was expanded to 150 meters.
For safety.
In 2009, 2010, Israel expanded the buffer to 300 meters.
They just want to be safe.
In 2010, the UN estimated that 30% of the arable land in Gaza has been lost to the buffer zone. It's a beach, right? It's
right,
like there's
know.
Some arable land further away from the ocean,
right?
But a lot of it is dunes,
yeah,
right? So there's you can't grow crops on a large portion of it,
right?
And the portion you can grow is further inland and close to the
and that's all been
fence.
Absorbed by this buffer zone.
A lot of it.
So they can't grow food to eat.
Yeah. In 2015, IDF confirmed the buffer zone of 300 meters for residents and 100 meters for farmers. However, they can't distinguish between
residents and farmers,
and they'll shoot anyone
they see there
with impunity. In 2015, one third of the agricultural land, because people on one third of the agricultural land risk Israeli attack. Because they will shoot people up to 1.5 kilometers from the border.
From the border.
17% of Gaza's total territory is within that high-risk zone.
This high-risk zone. That's a buffer zone for safety.
Yeah. So Israel and Egypt maintain a blockade. They allow only very limited traffic of mm-hmm. humanitarian supplies in and
right.
out.
Oh, and before you complain to me about the goddamn tunnels.
There are lots of tunnels on the
between
border
Egypt
with
and Gaza.
Egypt. This has been a thing. It's been a controversial thing.
How the hell else are you supposed to get antibiotics in Gaza?
Right.
If you can explain that to me, then we can talk about the tunnels.
And they have brought weapons through the tunnels. This
and?
Has happened. I'm just saying, it's not good to just pretend that it never happened. Right?
Well, no, I don't mean to pretend that it never happened. But I think if people are fighting a war of independence and you have a problem with them being armed to fight a war of independence,
right?
Maybe you don't understand what a war of independence is.
Exactly. So Israel restricts or allows goods depending on how they're feeling, you know, how
yeah, their mood,
things
you know,
are going on any
gassy
given
today,
time.
Just, you know.
Israel is the source of Gaza's water supply. Remember, they're on an ocean, but it's
yeah,
salt water.
It's
right?
salt water.
Electricity.
And they can't run any desalination plants or anything like
no.
that. They can't do any of that.
Electricity and communications infrastructure.
All of it runs through Israel.
The import of food is restricted through the Gazan blockade.
Mm-hmm.
And the Israeli military frequently sprays crops by drone
yeah.
or plane with
poison their food.
With toxic chemicals.
Wow. Is that a safety measure too?
They claim that they are doing it the same reason that we defoliated, you know, Central Asia, right?
Oh, for safety. They don't want anybody hiding in the crops.
Or South Asia. Yeah, like Agent Orange, you know, so that we could see the Viet Cong.
Viet Cong hiding.
Yeah.
That's right. So that's a safety measure.
Yeah. So importation of agricultural equipment is also heavily restricted.
Yeah. You can only send a Don Deere to Gaza to bulldoze houses.
Caterpillar.
Caterpillar, sorry.
Yeah.
You can only send Caterpillar equipment to Gaza to bulldoze houses. Right. That's the only reason they can be there.
Population is not free to leave or enter, and only in exceptional cases are people allowed to pass
through a checkpoint.
Through the Erez crossing or the Rafah border crossing. People are really bottled up there. It's
an open-air prison.
It is an open-air prison. Per capita income in 2009 was estimated at about $3,100, which puts it 164th in the world if you rated it by country.
Yeah.
70% of the population lives below the poverty line.
Yeah.
It is a mess. You know, the fortunes of Gaza kind of ebb and flow according to how Israel is feeling about the blockades and all that. Whether they allow them to build up some agriculture for a while or don't.
Well, no. They have a sweet little term of affection.
Yeah.
Sometimes they just need to mow the lawn.
Yeah.
So they let them grow for a while.
Right.
And then they come and mow the lawn.
Yeah. So, their products, as far as their economy, olives, citrus, vegetables, halal beef, and dairy products. Mm-hmm. But they are totally at the mercy of the border crossings as to whether they can sell this stuff.
To get it out, to be sold, to bring cash in.
They are dependent on Israel for import of electricity and fuel. Oslo Accords set limits for Palestinian production and importation of energy. The Israel Electric Corporation exclusively supplies the electricity. The amount of electricity has consistently been limited to 120 megawatts. Population's growing, right?
Yeah.
Constant power outages.
Constant. Brownouts daily.
So there's a complicated situation involving the greenhouses.
Yep.
And Gush Katif, the settlers.
Yeah.
Where they negotiated to have some of these greenhouses left behind for Gazans to work at, because many Gazans were employed there when the settlers were
living there,
running these greenhouses.
Oh, that's right. They got this cheap labor source. It's very nice.
Yeah, yeah. And go back a moment to what Juan Cole was saying about your colonists.
Yes.
Right. Your colonized people, how they essentially are labor.
And the stateless people you have there.
In the service of capital.
Right.
So that was a complicated thing, and some of the greenhouses were destroyed and some were left and all that. But if they show signs of economic improvement, that gets mowed down,
Get mowed down.
Yeah. The EU in 2014, the opinion of the EU was, today, Gaza is facing a dangerous and pressing humanitarian and economic situation with power outages across Gaza for up to 16 hours a day. As a consequence, the closure of sewage pumping operations, reduced access to clean water, a reduction in medical supplies and equipment, the cessation of imports of construction materials. So they knock down their buildings with airstrikes, right? And then don't allow them to bring construction materials.
Because, you know, anything could happen.
Rising unemployment, rising prices, and increased food insecurity. If left unaddressed, the situation could have serious consequences for stability in Gaza, for security more widely in the region, as well as for the peace process.
Right.
And that's what I'm talking about when I say Gaza is a demographic time bomb.
It's just a matter of time.
The border with Israel is 32 miles long.
Such as it is.
Yes, the line.
The quote border.
Yeah. And it has a 7-mile border with Egypt.
It's like basically from here to Detroit.
It's the whole area is roughly the size of Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Like greater Los Angeles.
Yeah.
I may have that wrong. Someone will probably tell me.
That sounds about right to me.
Yeah. Just to be clear. It's the size of an American city.
Mm-hmm.
All of Israel is about the size of Connecticut.
Yes.
It's not.
We're not talking about.
It causes an awful lot of trouble for being such a small area in square miles. Mm-hmm. The population density of Gaza is among the highest population density in the world.
Yeah.
It is a very dense city. People crammed in to a hot, dry area.
No water.
Total fertility rate estimated in 2014: 4.25 children per woman.
Mm-hmm.
Places Gaza 34th of 224 regions. According to the UN, unless remedial steps are taken to repair the basic infrastructure by 2020, the further demographic increase of 500,000 people and intensified housing problems, the Gaza Strip will become effectively uninhabitable.
Mm-hmm.
So either, like you say, it's either some solution or effectively an ethnic cleansing.
An ethnic cleansing. There's no other way out. And this is what I was thinking about that I left hanging before. I've never actually been a fan of the one-state solution.
No.
Because the one-state solution means Palestine doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
Right? Right. So I've never actually been a fan of the one-state solution.
What I see, though, is on the horizon is that if there's not a solution, then there is a no-state solution, a.k.a. a failed state solution.
A failed state solution, which I think is a possible outcome.
It's a very strong likelihood at this point.
Yeah. I mean, because who do they have in the region other than us and Saudi Arabia? Which, you know, is not trivial.
Yeah.
But, unless they're just going to nuke the whole thing.
Right.
I mean, because really, you can't drop a tactical nuke in a place the size of Connecticut.
Yeah, and not spread poison.
Poison everywhere.
Yeah.
Right? So, there's no good way out of this one. There really isn't. The joke for me for a long time has been, I've never been able to understand why the United States just didn't give diaspora Jews Long Island.
Yeah.
You know, like as a Jewish homeland, right?
Sure.
And I understand the sort of historic
racism,
connection to the place. And the historic racism that precludes that.
Right.
Because Jews only became white in the United States
recently.
In the 50s.
Right.
Right. That's a recent innovation that Jews are white.
Right.
So I get that. And I get I hesitate to use the word nostalgia, but the nostalgic connection to the land of a place of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
I really appreciate the Orthodox perspective that the temple was destroyed and that was lost.
Right.
That happened.
Yes.
It can't unhappen.
Right.
And there's some way in which a state doesn't unmake that and kind of perverts reality.
Yeah.
So not that I'm not an advocate that Jews should have a home in the world at all, but this was spoiled at the get-go.
It's the fruit of a poison tree.
Of it's fruit of a poison tree.
You and I have debated about whether a state founded on a theocratic ideal can even exist,
can even
be a state.
Can be a state. And I don't think this is theocratic per se, but I get what you're saying, yes.
Because a state founded on an ethnic ideal,
mm-hmm.
I don't think can be a modern state.
Really,
especially
you don't think
in this situation.
But you don't think an ethnic state can be a thing?
I don't think it should be a thing.
Really?
Well, the same way I don't believe that race is a thing.
But let me ask you this. Should Native Hawaiians have their Hawaii back?
Well, you're saying that when the temple was destroyed, you can't just... That happened.
That happened. You can't unmake it, right?
I know.
And in that same respect, one could say, well, an Akba happened. You can't go back. It's over.
Yeah.
I mean, you could say that. I mean, it's true.
I keep coming back in my head to the truth and reconciliation process in apartheid South Africa and how important that was.
Right.
Because I don't believe that bodies are ever buried forever.
No, no.
You know, unmarked graves.
They cry out for vengeance.
Yeah.
Every one of them.
And the thing devoutly to be wished is not vengeance, but justice.
Right.
And restorative justice is the only form of justice.
That will work.
That really will work and will heal communities. And this all comes down to communities.
Yeah.
But, so Israel is being run now and propped up by extremists. The settler movement is an extremist movement, and it's been in the driver's seat for way too long.
For a very long time.
And,
well, that's Bibi's base.
Yeah, and the Likud government, the right-wing government, is a disaster as far as the peace process goes.
Yeah.
And they are driving Israel into the ditch in the interest of security.
They're a clear and present danger to Israel's security.
These things are guaranteeing the failure of the Israeli idea in some form or another.
Right. Well, here's the question though I have. So if a state can't be theocratic.
Yeah.
And it can't be ethnic. What is it?
I actually have been walking around. You know, I'm supposed to be concentrating on my work at work.
Yeah, there's that.
But as I walk to and from the restroom and whatnot, I'm scratching my head going, what is the legitimate moral basis
for a state?
For founding a state?
I submit that there is none.
Yeah.
But that's me.
That's pretty much what I was concluding. Right.
I'm just saying, you're talking about the Palestinians needing a state to defend them. Well, you know.
Right.
I don't know about that. I'm just saying.
Yeah, because one will emerge, and it may not be,
It won't be.
It won't be the one we want. I mean,
but it won't be.
Because we've got,
the state never is.
Well, we had Arafat, right? And I'm not defending Arafat because his government was deeply corrupt. I'm not defending Hamas, but these organizations emerge, right? The same way that we pour billions into Israel's security, other
states
in the region with agendas of their own
pour money into
Palestine.
Right. So, and actually, I don't think to assert the right of people to defend themselves and fight for independence, right? I don't think that's defending Hamas or Yasser Arafat to say that it's okay for a group of people to fight for independence and to defend themselves. Just like people say, Israel has a right to defend itself. Israel has a right to exist to defend herself. Well, yeah. And so does Palestine.
Yeah.
So they needed guns for their fight for independence.
Right.
And your point. I mean, it's not like Israel's defending itself nonviolently.
Not that anyone pays attention to people who spout off about international law. It's like when Bush said, I'll be sure and consult my international lawyer,
Neater.
But the rules of engagement under international law say that the only justifiable use of deadly force is to protect people from deadly force.
Right.
The only justifiable use, the only way that the IDF's activities can be justified, shooting groups of people
hundreds of meters away,
is if they were a clear and present and
danger,
imminent threat.
Right. Of deadly force against someone.
Yes.
So really the only people that under international law that have a right to be using deadly force, the people who are being killed.
Yes.
Okay, and just note it.
There have, you know, Palestinians do lob rockets and kites and whatnot. That does happen.
Well, that happens.
But, and it's...
They're having a physical fight.
Yes. But the imminent is the thing, is the word.
That's the thing. That's the, right. That's the word right there. Yeah.
Because it really seems, from what I'm hearing, that IDF soldiers are just playing target practice, honestly.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah. And, and it's not clear, they're not living up to their own...
Their own standards.
Rules of engagement, right? Right.
It's repulsive.
So I'm trying to figure out how to wind this up.
Oh, God, if only. So...
There's a great piece that appeared in the New York Review of Books,
mm-hmm.
and...
Israel's Irrational Rationality.
Israel's Irrational Rationality by David Shulman. And it's a review of five different books, plus his own perspective on this.
Yeah.
And really the title that it appeared under on the cover of the NYRB, this is from
2014,
the June 22nd, 2017 issue.
It's last summer.
Was has something to do with how Israel's military victory has turned it into a complete moral failure.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's a valuable perspective.
And facts, you know, just the facts.
Let me offer some examples of life under the occupation of which I have personal knowledge. On March 5th, 2017, the residents of the Palestinian hamlet of Twana in the South Hebron Hills, Hebron, I guess, woke up to discover 15 of their olive trees hacked and destroyed, almost certainly by the notoriously violent settlers from adjacent Chavat Me'an. I probably pronounced that wrong. If we were to count the number of olive trees uprooted by settlers from the Twana lands over the last 10 years or so, it would easily reach the low hundreds. Olive trees are the primary source of support for many impoverished Palestinian families. In addition to the decimated fields, decimated trees, two fields of lentils were sprayed with poison. I would maintain that this kind of thing, if you are a leftist in any sense, if you claim to stand on the side of the underdog, settle, you know, on the side of the impoverished and injured and vulnerable, there's no decision to be made here.
Yeah, there's nothing
as to who you're going to defend.
Right.
2 months earlier, on January 7, the same settlers from Chavat Me'an violently attacked a group of Israeli peace activists that were accompanying Palestinian farmers seeking to plow a field. I was there with another party of activists, a little farther down the hill, and I witnessed the arrival of the wounded in Twana. One hit by a rock on the head, two others badly beaten, still more with contusions, and one with a smashed camera.
Right.
Children from the Twana area are at constant risk of being attacked by settlers on their way to school in the village. The daughter of a friend of mine, Ali from Touba, nearly lost an eye in such an attack. The army has been forced to provide a military escort to take them to and from school, but even that is not always enough. There have been occasions when the soldiers stood idly by while settlers beat the Palestinian children with clubs and metal chains. I'm skipping ahead a little bit.
Keep in mind, this is a group of adults beating a group of children. As soldiers watch.
A diary that kept track of such assaults on Palestinians would run to thousands of pages with daily, perhaps hourly, entries. I mentioned I used to read the Journal of Palestinian Studies. I tried to catalog these. I tried to read.
There's a lot of data.
Translated.
There's a mountain of data.
Yeah, newspapers that were published in Hebrew to get more closer to primary sources. Right. And I have not yet mentioned the endless demolitions of Palestinian houses, entire villages such as Sasiya and Umm al-Khayr are in danger of extinction, or the remorseless processes of expulsion and ethnic cleansing that we see everywhere in the occupied territories. Mm-hmm. The occupation is also a surreal world of denial, where lies mask themselves as truth, and truth can't be uttered, at least not by the officers and politicians that hold power. The settlers, however obnoxious, bear only a portion of the blame for the atrocities they commit. They carry out the policies of the Israeli government, in effect maintaining a useful, steady level of state terror directed against a large civilian population. None of this can be justified by rational argument. All of it stains the character of the state and has, in my experience, horrible effects on the minds and hearts of young soldiers who have to carry out the orders they are given.
Right.
A few unusually aware and conscientious ones have had the courage to speak out. As always in such situations, most people just go along.
Right.
So that's a bit.
It's an excerpt from Solomon. We'll have links for you guys.
We'll put links in the show notes.
So,
in March, President Trump's, I'm skipping ahead, special emissary to the region, Jason Greenblatt, arrived with the apparent aim of generating movement towards a regional settlement. Somewhat surprisingly, people on both sides liked him, including Palestinian refugees in the camps and Israeli settlers on the West Bank. One major exception, it seems, was Benjamin Netanyahu, who, according to the reports, was asked by Greenblatt to come up with concrete steps to curtail settlement activities, along with some statement of what compromises he would ultimately be prepared to make. Predictably, even under Trump, the old blueprint for partition along familiar lines has surfaced again. It refuses to go away.
How can it go away?
One should never underestimate Netanyahu's uncanny ability to stall, prevaricate, and eradicate even the slightest glimmer of hope. This means essentially the status quo, being that the occupation continues to grow.
Right.
More and more territory is constantly being seized and
right.
homes demolished and, you know, farms stolen. But maybe the thrall principle will yet be put into practice. The president's visit to Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Palestinian Bethlehem in May on his first foreign trip is, I suppose, meant to suggest that he is serious about pursuing a deal. As several friends of mine, Israelis and Palestinians, have said, if Donald Trump were somehow to impose an agreement, this would prove not that God exists, but that if he does, he has a sense of humor. Well, this was written in 2017, and I think
here's the deal.
We should probably end there because
we're looking at the deal.
We're looking at the deal in which, again, you know,
it's not very funny.
A person without principles listens to the dumbest people in the room with the most money and
with the most clout with his base.
The most clout with his base and makes the worst possible choices.
Well, not for his reelection.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
I kind of dragged that out. We were disorganized and...
As usual. It was good.
But I've been... this has been troubling me. And I'm sure it's been... I know it's been troubling you as well.
Yeah.
We hold out hope for better days.
I hold out hope for Palestine.
Yeah.
I don't know that Israel will really survive in the long run.
Yeah. Not without, like I say, this truth and reconciliation.
Not without a serious reckoning.
Yeah. Okay, everyone.
That's all for this week.
Thanks you for listening. Bye-bye.